Goeienaand, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Ons het vanavond vir Jim Adams daar in Amerika by ons, ook vir Willie Koorts in die Kaap en professor Mati Hofman in Bloemfontein. Maar heel eerste, ruimte weer, hier is Kobus Olkers in Amerika.
Goeienaand en goeienaand luisteraars. Ja, terug uit Canada, hier in Florida. Kom ons kyk een bykie wat sê die son hierdie week vir ons. Ja, verlede week het ons heel wat pret gehad met die uitbarstings, die groot actieve area wat nou reeds van die son af weggedraai het in die tyd wat ons hierna luister. Ons het een mooie geomagnetische storm gesien, die eerste en die tweede. Maar nou ja, het is nou voorbij en kom ons kyk wat hierdie week vir ons voor. Ons het een paar actieve areas nog op die son, die groot een wat so baie complex was, is nou weg, nummer 2860. Die wat oor is baie mooi, hulle is redelijk groot, maar hulle is mooi, magnetisch mooi goed uitgelê. En ons kan gaan dus nie die vreselike magnetische spanning skryf wat opbou, wanneer ons die pole so kruis met mekaar nie. So ek verwag nie enige groot uitbarstings nie, daar is wel een filament wat bezig is om energie op te tel. Hy is in een geo-effectieve positie op die oomblik en as hy uitbars, dan kan het vir ons nog een klein fakkeltje gee, maar dit is een ander type fakkel en ons behoort nie probleme van hom af te hee wat ons apparaat aan betref nie. Dan wat ons coronagate betref, daar is een wat nou so pas geo-effectief geraak het. Hy sit in die suidelike halfsom rond van die son en hy het een lang sleert wat so afgaan tot by die pool, so skyns af. En ons gaan nog so redelijk van hom weet in die achtergrond so vir die volgende paar dae. Tenminste tot so donderdagse koers die sou ek sê. Die stereosatelliet sê vir my dat hy selfs eentje achter die rand van die son nog in is, en dis het ons hele paar dae van hom af. Maar die enigste probleem, mense wat daarmee probleem gaan hee, is die mense wat met lang afstand kortgolf radio werk. Nou ja, dis ons story vir hierdie week. Goeienaand allemaal.
Baie dankie Kobus. Ons het vanavond, soos elke eerste sonnag in die maand, vir Jim Adams daar in Amerika by ons. Goeienaand Jim.
Goeienaand Henny.
Hy praat al goed Afrikaans. En ons het ook vir Willie Koorts. Goeienaand Willie.
Hallo die kant.
En dan vir Mati Hofman. Hallo Mati.
Hallo Henny. Hallo Jim. And Willie.
Hallo.
Right, we're going to talk about something interesting this evening, and that's the James Webb Space Telescope. Why are we talking about that? It's due to start its journey down to French Guiana, where it will be launched. And I think the obvious question, Jim, in the beginning is, why there and not in the US?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. So part of the partnership between NASA and the European Space Agency to make this telescope included the Europeans supplying the launch vehicle. Well, the primary workhorse launch vehicle for Europe is the Ariane, and the Ariane launch site is in French Guiana. Why French Guiana? And it's because if you think about Europe, they don't really have any clear zones facing eastward, which is the direction you want to launch if you are going into an orbit that isn't polar around the Earth. You generally don't launch westward because you lose the energy from the spin of the Earth. So the French Ariane company set up a launch base as close to the equator as they could and launch eastward from French Guiana.
And, you know, we all know the Hubble Space Telescope. It's been there for quite a while. The James Webb Telescope, where does it get its name from?
Yeah, so James Webb was the NASA administrator just as the agency started, which was like 1958-ish, I think. I don't remember the exact date when the agency started, but James Webb was the administrator of NASA from 1961 to 1968. And he was considered one of the first managers that was able to easily meld human spaceflight and science into what the mission of the agency is today. And so they honored him by naming this telescope after him. You know, Henny, I should mention that most missions don't get named after people until after they've launched. In this particular case, NASA chose to name the mission well ahead of the launch. And I'll tell you, it was for largely political reasons. We wanted to honor James Webb, of course. But it is more difficult to cancel a mission after it's got a name. If we had just been calling it the Next Space Telescope, Congress could have easily killed it. But it takes on a personality. Many missions do. Hubble has a personality. So to name a telescope after a person or a space mission after a person begins to activate the culture, and the citizens of the United States start to rally behind it. And that's one of the reasons I think that James Webb endured all of the trials it had. You know, it had lots of technology issues. We could talk about those if you want. And a mission that the public didn't accept quite so readily might have been canceled. So naming it was actually a political move to try and make sure that it was less likely to be canceled.
I think what one should do is just to quickly describe what is the difference between Hubble and James Webb.
Yeah. So Hubble is predominantly a visual visual light telescope, and James Webb is almost exclusively infrared. And so the idea of being able to look at the universe in the infrared in a zone where they can keep the spacecraft very, very cold, that will help us to use it as kind of a time machine, if you will, right? We will be looking back into the start of the universe, like on the order of 300 million years after the Big Bang. And that's almost as deep as anybody's been able to see, except maybe the Meerkat and hopefully someday the Square Kilometer Array. So it's a remarkable thing. What happens is the visual light from that time frame travels towards us or travels through space, and it redshifts over time. That means it goes from visible more towards the red. And so when you look at the infrared with a telescope, you're actually looking at how it looked. You're looking at the visible light, how it looked all those many millions of years, billions of years ago, when the light was first emitted.
The difference in the mirrors, because we know Hubble has a single mirror, whereas James Webb, it's a different story.
Yeah. In fact, there's a little bit of a South African connection there too, and Billy may want to chime in, but the Hubble mirror is ground glass, and a perfect prescription, which we, after we launched it, we found out was wrong. So then they came up with this scheme to basically put a contact lens on the Hubble, and it worked for a while. And then anytime they sent up a new instrument, they would correct for the error in the grinding of this primary mirror on the Hubble Space Telescope. James Webb is going to a place where we will not be able to send humans to service it. It's going to the Lagrange 2 point. That is a point between beyond the Earth that balances the gravity and the rotational forces, and it will hover there in a halo orbit around the L2. It's about 1 million miles out, which is roughly 4 times the distance to the moon. And so we won't be sending humans there to service it. So it has to be like perfect. And, you know, when we had that embarrassment with the Hubble, we went to a great deal of trouble to make sure that we knew exactly what the prescription was going to be for the James Webb mirror. Well, in order to do that, and to make it easier to adjust, they decided to build these mirrors in hexagonal segments. Of course, the Hubble mirror is, I think it's about 2 meters across. The James Webb Space Telescope is 6.3, made up of 18 hexagonally shaped mirrors, and they're made out of very light beryllium. And they look gold because they're supposed to be reflecting infrared and not the visible light. So, and I tell you, the first time I went to Sutherland to see SALT, I was impressed with the similarities between the SALT telescope and Hubble. Maybe, Vili, you want to mention that?
Yes, that's correct. Yeah, as you say, 1.3-meter diameter hexagonal segments. SALT is 91 segments of slightly smaller 1 meter diameter, roughly, and of course it's got an overall diameter of 11 meters. So it's roughly about half the size. The James Webb will be about half the size, and in diameter in light gathering. But as you say, these hexagonal segments that make up the primary mirror, there's of course a few differences. As you already mentioned, the gold coating instead of aluminium or for white light. And in fact, the Hubble-Ebbele telescope, the HET in Texas, in the McDonald Observatory, from which SALT was copied, there they actually even wanted to extend into the ultraviolet. So they actually went for a silver coating initially, which gives you a slight extension into the ultraviolet. The other difference, and one of the main differences, would be that the James Webb telescope segments would together form a parabola, which means that they will be focusing on a single point. Of course, there is a secondary mirror that takes the light down, which the instrument's sitting at the back of the main mirror, like with many of the other telescopes in Sutherland. The main mirror of SALT is, of course, spherical. And the main reason there being is that the telescope is stationary while you're doing observation, and the whole secondary arrangement is moving around to compensate for the rotation of the Earth. So that because the Earth keeps rotating, you have to compensate for that somehow. In the James Webb, of course, the telescope will be out there in space, and therefore you wouldn't need to be able to compensate for any rotation, because the whole telescope will be rotating and then being pointed at the stars. And of course, you've already mentioned the weight. Yeah, the James Webb, if I look on its Wikipedia page, 6.5 tons for the whole instrument, telescope plus instrumentation, where SALT weighs 90 tons, so quite a difference. But of course, SALT has got to be supported by gravity, where this telescope doesn't have any problems with gravity as such.
I notice here another difference. You are quite proud of yourself when it gets so cold there in Sutherland, say around minus 15 degrees centigrade in winter. But the James Webb telescope's mirror, they're going to try to maintain a temperature of around minus 220 degrees. Yeah. So that's extremely cold. Jim, why is that? And I also noted you mentioned the beryllium, gold-plated beryllium, but then they also mentioned here an aluminium-coated captain. That is a strange material that most people will not know what that's about.
Yeah. So I was actually looking at you bring up a really good point about the temperature of the telescope. The telescope needs to be at that temperature to assure that we aren't getting interference from itself, from infrared emissions from itself. So there is this sunshade that will unfurl after launch. It'll unfurl. It's made of five layers of, as you say, coated Kapton, aluminum coated Kapton. And it's like a space blanket, right? And that's what it's used for, is to reject the heat from the sun and allow the telescope to be exposed to the darkness of space and basically cool down as cold as they can make it. And you had the temperature was minus 200 and something. But on the front side, the side that faces the sun, it's going to be well over 200 degrees. So this sunshade will unfurl and it will protect the rest of the telescope, the primary mirror and secondary and the instruments, from getting too warm, so that they can see very, very cold, distant objects. This sunshade, by the way, is the size of a tennis court. That in and of itself is a huge challenge, but also the idea of building a spacecraft that's so very hot on one end and extremely cold on the other end was also an enormous challenge, which is why it took over 20 years to develop this telescope.
Just a question. I noticed that they have spent quite a number of years testing the James Webb telescope. Could they test it under extreme low temperatures?
They did put it in a thermal vacuum chamber, and they got it very, very low. You know, they can run liquid nitrogen through the walls of the vacuum chamber and get it extremely low. I don't know if they actually got to the final temperature that it'll reach on orbit. They probably did. They can use liquid nitrogen. They can also use liquid helium if they need to. So it becomes a thing where they adjust the test regime so that they're testing it like it flies. And I believe they probably did get it that cold for a period of time. It spent months inside the vacuum chamber down at Johnson Space Center in Texas, which is unusual for a telescope or for a spacecraft. Usually we want to get in and get out of the vacuum chamber as quickly as we possibly can, and they spend about 2 weeks. But this one spent months in that chamber.
Yeah, of course, it was obviously lessons learned from Hubble Space Telescope as well. The telescope wasn't, although they tested the individual bits, they never tested the whole telescope complete.
Yes.
And that was a bit of a lesson learned there. It was the most accurate mirror ever made as far as surface finish was concerned, but the whole thing was slightly out. So it's like setting your clocks hour hand exactly, but the second hand is wrong or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And do you know, one of the other things that isn't getting a lot of talk about these days, I think mostly because we've just pretty much forgotten about it, is in the back of each of these segments, these hexagonal mirror segments, there is an actuator that has the capability of deforming the mirror just a little bit.
Okay.
So that if for some reason the prescription of the mirror is off, or it's just not reflecting correctly, they can change the shape of the mirror, of each of the individual mirror segments, just a tad, so that they can try and recover from a problem like they had with the Hubble Space Telescope. Hmm.
Jim, were you involved in any way with the James Webb Telescope?
Well, in 2020, I was part of a technology development team that was looking at options for new mirror types. We knew we couldn't use the mirror that was going to be or that had been used for the Hubble Space Telescope. We needed something much, much lighter and obviously in the infrared. And so I was part of a technology development team that was looking at those options. But from there, I got involved in solar physics and planetary science and technology, and really never came back to Hubble except to be on a few review teams while I was at headquarters.
Yeah. You said 2020. You probably mean, but earlier.
I'm sorry, 2000. 2000. Thank you very much. Yeah. I was retired in 2020.
Okay.
Yeah. Speaking of 2020, it's a remarkable thing that these guys were able to complete such a mammoth undertaking of integrating the spacecraft and testing it, all while dealing with COVID restrictions and travel problems and, just everything that we were dealing with in 2020. I mean, these guys deserve a round of applause for that, for sure.
Yes, talking of the people that will be operating the telescope, I know the Hubble is operated by the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore. Is it the same crowd?
Same crowd. These guys are looking forward to operating that telescope. They've been waiting for it a long time, and they're looking forward to getting the science back. And the Space Telescope Science Institute is like the premier place to go to get Hubble data, Spitzer data, and now James Webb data. So. Mm-hmm.
The type of observations that we can look forward to. The Hubble telescope is famous for, among many other things, it's Hubble Deep Field, Hubble Ultra Deep Field. Can we wait for a James Webb Deep Field?
I believe so. I think you guys are going to be totally amazed. And, that's the cool thing about the job that we all do is every time we look into the universe that we're in, we see something amazingly different. And it doesn't matter if you're going to Mercury or Venus or Mars, or if you're looking at stars in the Milky Way or stars in galaxies beyond, it's always different and just absolutely stunning. Makes us question, how did we get here?
Yes, I always say, Jim, that the space we know now of is the result of insight on the one side and then instruments on the other side. If you develop instruments, it can make space bigger, is it?
It's interesting. I can relate this to sort of Mars. There was this fella named Lowell who'd made some observations of Mars with a rudimentary telescope. And he surmised, using his instinct and his intuition, that these features that he saw on Mars were filled with water. And he presumed that Mars was very much like Earth when he was making the measurements. And of course, we get there, and it's not like that at all. It may have been like that, but it isn't like that today. And so there's not these canals with water flowing like he had envisioned. And we find that out as technology evolves, right? So when as a scientist, you see something, you try and classify it along with something you already know. But if you're seeing something absolutely new and different, it's possible you don't even know you're seeing something absolutely new and different. And so that's why science evolves, and the knowledge of the universe is constantly changing. And that's why I don't get upset when somebody says, oh, well, we thought this, but that turned out to not be true, and so now we need to look at this, at something else. And you can also see that even in how the World Health Organization is dealing with our pandemic. Yeah, as more data becomes available, we take different actions.
Yeah, I think I want to close off, Jim, by asking you, what makes you excited? Where you are now. I mean, you're now retired, but you're not really retired.
It was a privilege to work for NASA and the United States public for all those years, and doing things like this, Henny, is giving back to me, and it's just simply a pleasure to try and explain something as complicated as a space telescope to somebody who might just get inspired enough to either raise their own children, or I might be speaking to children who would want to continue the exploration of the universe that we live in.
Yeah, all I can say is yeah, yeah. Thank you, Jim. People can
buy a donkey.
Buy a donkey, yeah. People can reach you on the Facebook page.
Absolutely. I love answering questions on Facebook.
Yeah, our Facebook page is 20,000 plus.
Yeah, we've gone through 20,000 recently, 20,000 members, and people are still relatively well behaved and nice lively discussions and so forth. Yeah, yeah, it's going pretty well there. Yeah, yeah.
Jou besonderhede?
Ja, mense kan bel SMS WhatsApp op 0724 45 79 208.
Mati? 0836257154. 0836257154. En dan die program se e-pos adres is sterreplanete@gmail.com. Ons sê tot ziens, tot volgende week. Alles van die beste.